against Stone Creek Mechanical.
Good morning. I'm Philip Bradbury of the law firm of Melly Walker Pease and Rooley in Madison, Wisconsin. And with me this morning is one of my partners, Jennifer Kramer. We represent the appellant Stone Creek Mechanical Company from Pennsylvania that is a HVAC contractor. And we appeal from the judgment of the Western District Court, Wisconsin. U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin. We ask this court to reverse the decisions of that court based on the two-day trial that appeared before Judge Crabb, and that the matter be remanded to the District Court for a hearing on damages on Stone Creek's counterclaims. In many respects, the case that we have before you today is a run-of-the-mill, typical commercial dispute between a contractor and a supplier. We have a purchase order by a contractor and a acceptance of that purchase order by the supplier. And if you just look at those two documents, you wonder why the parties had such terrible disputes as reflected in the record. And I think in going through the record and going through the legal arguments that were presented to the district court, you'll see a pattern by the district court in rejecting many of the arguments we make, primarily because of a dislike of Mr. Richard Wirth, who is the owner of Stone Creek Mechanical. And the court obviously understands the burden we have to overcome some of those factual findings. But those factual findings can largely be set aside on a couple of key issues in the case, and I'd like to address three key issues this morning. One, the court did enter a partial summary judgment order in favor of Stone Creek Mechanical on our motion as to whether a contract had been formed between the parties. And this summary judgment order is not a subject of an appeal today. I think both parties accept the court's findings and legal analysis. But the summary judgment decision is important because it affects the later decisions of the court, because, as I'll later argue, it's hard to have the summary judgment decision stand alongside order of the court finding that there was a modification of that decision. So that's one issue I'll address with the court this morning. The second issue is whether the court was in error in finding that a letter dated October 25th, 2001, from Stone Creek Mechanical to Carnes constituted a modification of the contract, and the contract being the contract that the court found on summary judgment. And this issue is important because if the contract was not modified, we're still operating under the contract that was the subject of the summary judgment motion. But even if it had been modified, I think as a matter of law, this court can look at the court's findings and interpret that modification and what the effect of that would be. And the third issue I'd like to address, to the extent I have time, is the court's application of Uniform Commercial Code Section 2-207, which deals with modifications to contracts based on subsequent documents provided by the parties. So those are the three issues I'd like to address. The first issue is the summary judgment decision, and this decision is important because it left no doubt in anyone's mind as to what the contract was between the parties. Stone Creek issued a purchase order in March of 2001. On June 27th, Carnes submitted a written acceptance of that purchase order, and the court found that as a matter of no dispute of fact and as a matter of law that Carnes was responsible for providing 50 energy recovery units for $640,000. Now, in Carnes' acceptance, they told Stone Creek, we're going to subcontract or assign part of this contract to a company by the name of Chase. And that's stated in there, but the court found, and it's not been disputed by any party, that even though you were signing that or subcontracting it, Carnes still ultimately was responsible for doing that work. And the acceptance by Carnes was, as the court found, it was an acceptance in full of the purchase order. There was not a contingency. There were no conditions to the acceptance. It was a complete acceptance. So as of that, based on that finding, we have a contract between the parties as to what Carnes' obligations are, and their obligations are to do all the work under the purchase order for $640,000.
I thought the acceptance specified that Carnes would be responsible for some portion of the contract that was less than that $600,000 number, that the balance would be assigned to Chase, and that when your client faxed its own acceptance of that back or acknowledgement of that back, some of it was whited out, which is what caused the confusion.
As to the first part of your question, in the summary judgment decision, the court did find that Carnes had decided to subcontract or assign part of it to Chase. But as a matter of law, that did not relieve Carnes of the responsibility to perform that work. So I think we're operating under, regardless of what our client did in responding, at that point the contract had been formed.
But the judge's fact-finding and conclusions of law at trial replaced whatever had been decided previously, as I understand the record.
Well, that's one of our arguments, is was it appropriate for the court to, in essence, reverse or replace the summary judgment decision?
Why is that inappropriate after hearing all the evidence for her to do that?
Well, in standard litigation, you review your facts, you review your record, you review the legal issues, and you go to summary judgment, just as the parties argued before us do, and you present that to the court. And the court rules either for you or against you, and then you proceed with the case and make decisions on how to litigate. In this case, the court ruled in our favor and said, this is the contract. And we relied on that. Both parties relied on it. The other party does not dispute that. That was the contract. And I think it's unfair for the court to now basically reverse that at trial based on other testimony that the other party could have easily submitted if they chose to as part of the summary judgment motion.
So
the party did not.
If she decides, the district court, that is, that the original summary judgment motion was factually and legally incorrect, she's prohibited from altering that after hearing all the evidence at trial and a bench trial?
I would like to research that specific issue, but I think based on the rule of the law of the case, I would imagine that once a decision of that type is made and neither party asks for a reconsideration of it, that would be the law of the case, and the parties can rely on that. Now, if the court wanted to,
law of the case counts for nothing here. What the district court decided at stage N of the case is immaterial in the Court of Appeals, which means once you're here, if the district court decided to reexamine it, it's been reexamined. The only question for us is whether the district court's ultimate decision is a legal error.
Well, I would find myself between certainly a rock and a hard place if I get a favorable decision on summary judgment and then I go to trial and the court, in essence,
favorable decision on summary judgment in the district court never counts for anything in the Court of Appeals. Right? The only question for us is whether the district court is right, not any procedural allocations.
Well, as to whether
that matters to us now is the outcome of the trial. What happened at the summary judgment stage is irrelevant.
Thank you. Well, as to what happened at trial, we do have the court recognizing that that the court did enter the summary judgment, that there was a contract, and that contract had been modified. And that's the next issue at trial is there's plenty of evidence in the record as to who did what, who was right, who was wrong. But we ultimately get to this October 25th letter that Stone Creek sends to Carnes, in which the court found was a modification of the contract. And if you look at the letter, it basically talks about paying two invoices and getting two units delivered on an expedited basis. That letter was then followed up by a change order by Carnes that they were charging an additional fee for that expedited order. But if you look at that modification, the letter that the court found was a modification, there's nothing in that letter that would suggest that it modifies anything other than the payment terms with respect to those units and the delivery schedule with respect to those units. There's nothing in that letter that in any way tells Carnes that you don't have to do anything else in the performance of your contract. You're relieved from the Chase part of the work that was assigned. It simply dealt with that specific situation. And I don't think there's any reasonable way, based on the record in the case, to interpret it any other way. But even if we accept the court's findings, I would think that a modification of a contract, or the document that she found to be a modification, that would be a legal interpretation, just like you would be interpreting a contract document that was not ambiguous. So we would ask this court to look at that modification and find that either wasn't a modification, or if it was a modification, that all it did was change the payment terms on those few units, and then the parties were to proceed to complete the work in accordance with the terms of the original contract. And nowhere in the record or in the court's decision does the court find that the contract was that the parties agreed to throw the contract at the window or anything. She says in her decision that the case turns on the interpretation of that October 25th modification. And we think if you look at that modification, it does very little than confirm the payment terms, net 30 days, that the parties had agreed to originally. The third issue I'd like to address is the application of Section 2.207. And this does go back again to the original contract and the court's finding that summary judgment that a contract had been formed. In our research and as presented in our brief, we don't think Section 2.207 of the Uniform Commercial Code applies to this situation. I think any reading, fair reading of that section and the notes to it, the comments to it, say that applies to two situations. One, where we have an informal agreement that the parties are then going to confirm, or it's an acceptance with a condition or contingency attached to it. Neither of those situations are found in this case. In this case, we're dealing with a contract which the court did find had been accepted in full, and that decision is not modified by the court's decision after trial. The court said that my finding on the summary judgment that the court, the decision, the contract was formed with that acceptance is not modified. If you take that, Section 2.207 should not apply. And if it doesn't apply, the court's findings that the parties accepted the acknowledgments, the terms and the acknowledgments with respect to interest and attorney's fees should not have applied, and those parts of the court's rulings should be reversed. But even if we get past the 2-207 and look at the interest and attorney's fees situation, the record does show that attorney's fees is a material term, material change in the terms of the contract, the party's contract. And as for interest, we accept that that's probably not a material change, but the Carnes never charged interest, never put it on any invoices until the lawsuit was started. So we would argue there that they have waived their right to that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bradbury. Mr. Plumershut.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Kevin Palmersheim, and may it please the court, I have 3 points that I want to address on behalf of my client, Carnes Company, Inc. I think I can address these points in large part by responding to some of the questions that were raised in appellant's argument. First, I'd like to state that this is not a run-of-the-mill contract case, and I think that was recognized at the trial court. The trial court said that successful business contracts are like Tolstoy's Happy Families. They produce little in the way of drama. This case produced a lot of drama, and that had to do with the credibility issues that were central in the trial. Credibility was not limited to the narrow issues, as appellant would have you believe. It was central to many of the issues that are before this court. And credibility determinations, as we know, are due great deference from the Court of Appeals on review. The second issue is the summary judgment decision, which was addressed briefly. That was on a very narrow issue of whether, as of June 27, 2001, Carnes was responsible for the ultimate $640,000 contract price. That did not address the number of changes that occurred around June 27th and soon thereafter, what was in the contract, and also what happened with the modification of the contract and at trial. And finally, the standards of review that have been put forth by the parties are in conflict. The standards of review, I think, on most of these issues are subject to the clearly erroneous standard, whereas appellant has argued that most of the issues should be decided de novo. On the credibility issues, there was calculated deception right from the start in this case. And this is important because these factual findings and credibility issues were in the trial court's decision. That's record number 85. It's not in the appendix before the court. Right from the start, appellant used correction fluid to change terms in the contract. Typical practice in the trade is that if you have changes to a contract, you're negotiating back and forth, you cross those changes out, you initial in the margins. Right from the start, there was deception in using whiteout to eliminate provisions of the contract. Soon thereafter, there were disputed faxes and letters, certified mailings, that appellant says it sent to my client, Carnes. These documents were not, in fact, ever received. Now, these documents addressed the terms and conditions for attorney fees and interest and other issues that Carnes was imposing under the contract. So the appellant knew early on that these were key issues and wanted to create a record saying that it was disputing those, but it also knew that if it actually notified Carnes of this fact, that Carnes would likely not fulfill the contract. The evidence at trial shows that the trial court did not believe that these documents were actually delivered to Carnes. There were many disputed documents. Carnes had evidence that fax pages were received that were blank. They had evidence that they'd received certified mailings on one day. They had copies of what was received in those certified mailings. And later, Stone Creek argued that it had sent other documents in those certified mailings other than the ones that were actually received. These are all important credibility issues when it comes to the other decisions that the trial court had to make in terms of whether Stone Creek breached the contract, whether it intended modification of the contract by virtue of the letter delivered on October 25th of 2001. The credibility issues also relate to the attorney fees and interest because there is a dispute as to whether or not Stone Creek had the terms and conditions imposing interest and attorney fees as of the date the contract was entered into. Now, we argue that it doesn't matter because there was a change starting June 27th or June 28th and certainly by October 25th that there was a modification that did include these attorney fees and interest. But if we focus on the narrow issue of the original contract, we still believe that the attorney fees and interest provisions were included in that original contract. The reason is there is evidence in the record that shows that Stone Creek's project manager wanted warranty information. In March 16th of 2001, made a request to Carnes for warranty information. Soon thereafter, Carnes sent this warranty information to its agent, who in turn sent it to Chase. Chase was a separate independent contractor that was dealing directly with Stone Creek. Stone Creek has said that all the communications during this time before June 27th, June 28th of 2001 were through Chase. So the dispute, Stone Creek is saying that it did not have evidence of the warranties and the terms and conditions by that date, when in fact all the communications were flowing through Chase at that time, and the evidence shows that whatever went into Chase's hands went into Stone Creek's hands. In addition, Mr. Wirth testified that he believed as of June 27th of 2001 that he had in his possession the acknowledgments of Carnes, and those acknowledgments also had the terms and conditions for interest and attorney fees. That was on the third day of testimony. That's record number 76 at page 13. So in terms of credibility, again, we're faced with a situation where on attorney fees and interest, Stone Creek did have that information. The trial court did believe and made a finding of fact that Stone Creek had that information, and that finding of fact can't be overturned unless it's clearly erroneous, and we believe there's evidence to support it. Next issue that appellant's counsel brought up was the UCC 402.207, whether that applied in this case. Well, the only argument that appellant made before trial was that 207 did not apply because they had, in fact, rejected the interest and attorney fees that were part of these invoices and part of these acknowledgments. But the trial court found that those rejections were in these fabricated mailings and certified mailings that were sent that, excuse me, that were not sent, that were actually not received by Carnes. So in terms of 402.207 applying under the UCC, that argument, at least before trial, was on that very narrow issue, and the trial court's findings on that found that the evidence submitted by Stone Creek was not credible. We next get to the issue of the modification letter, which was October 25th of 2001. Again, we're looking at credibility issues here. Appellant says that this modification letter did not change the terms of the contract. But if you look at that letter, the letter states that payment will be made by November 17th, 2001 on all invoices that are over 30 days old. Well, the invoices were in Stone Creek's hands as of September 10th of 2001. The terms, which Stone Creek acknowledges, were net 30. So the payment was due no later than October 10th. Clearly, there had been a change in terms because those payments were due. Carnes and Stone Creek were agreeing to different terms for the payment under the original contract. In addition, Stone Creek requested that one unit be expedited. This was not in the original contract. This unit was expedited, produced by Carnes, and in the letter, Stone Creek agrees that it's going to pay an expedited charge for that additional unit. So this is something that was not included in the original contract. Finally, the invoices were directly referred to in the October 25th letter. And Stone Creek is arguing that earlier it did not have knowledge of the terms and conditions Carnes was imposing for interest and attorney fees. Well, this October 25th letter directly refers to Carnes' invoices, and those terms and conditions were on the invoices. So Stone Creek is agreeing to abide by those terms and conditions unless it specifically rejected them, which it did not do. Stone Creek further argues that there's a breach of contract in this case by Carnes. Well, the whole breach of contract argument is based on the items that are attached to another letter sent after this modification. This modification occurs on October 25th. Mr. Wirth, the president of Stone Creek, notifies Carnes he's going to be out of the country until November 11th. Carnes expedites the unit that was requested, ships it on October 29th. On November 6th, while Mr. Wirth is supposedly out of the country, he sends a letter to Carnes with this long list of attachments saying that Carnes breached the contract. And many of these attachments are the letters we referred to earlier that Carnes never received. But this is the first indication by Stone Creek that there's any problem in the contract. And that happens on November 6th, and that's conveniently after Carnes has performed and has relied on the promises made by Stone Creek and delivered these extra units. And these units were what was necessary for Stone Creek to finish the first phase of the project, and that's why Stone Creek waited until after October 25th and after that unit was shipped before giving this November 6th letter. This was also a factual finding and a credibility determination by the court. The court noted that this November 6th letter looked like it had been put together much earlier. There was a timeline in the letter that went up through mid-September of 2001 that Mr. Wirth had put together. Well, so much had happened after mid-September that it would seem to be, if Stone Creek is arguing for breach, that it would include those extra items that occurred in October, those communications, the modification letter. And the trial court found that this letter had been actually created probably in September, and Stone Creek was just waiting to send it until after Carnes had performed. Want to also address some of the issues on standard of review. The standard of review on these issues is a clearly erroneous standard on many of them. Whether attorney fees or interest materially alter a contract under the UCC is a question of fact. The Ludke case cited in the brief indicates it's a question of fact. The Comark case specifically addresses the issue of attorney fees and says that whether the attorney fees constitute a material alteration under 2207 is a question of fact. So that's subject to the clearly erroneous standard. Whether Stone Creek waived any claims it had against Carnes, or alternatively whether Carnes waived any contract issues against Stone Creek, those are questions of fact. It's stipulated in appellant's brief that the Thompson case applies there. On the issue of waiver under the UCC, the American Suzuki case applies the clearly erroneous standard to the issue of waiver based on an attempted modification under the UCC. Judge Mannion, I believe you authored this decision, and there are two issues on modification. One, you can have a modification of a contract, and that imposes new terms and conditions. If there's an attempted modification that does not amount to an actual modification under the law, then that can amount to a waiver. And in order to have a waiver, there needs to be reliance. Well, in this case, the reliance was that Carnes got the October 25th letter. It expedited an additional unit. It shipped 4 units on October 29th, and it did this in exchange for promises that it would be paid, and then after that, Stone Creek reneged on its promises. Those are questions of fact. They were all found by the trial court in favor of Carnes. Whether Carnes engaged in anticipatory repudiation, this is another issue that was raised in the reply brief and in the initial brief by appellant, and it argues that this is a de novo consideration. But the Wisconsin Dairy case cited by appellant indicates that the issue of anticipatory repudiation is reviewed based on whether the trial court's findings were against the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence. So again, we have a factual issue here, whether the factual findings are clearly erroneous. Finally, there's an argument on the proper measure of damages, and the appellant is arguing that that issue, too, should be reviewed de novo by this court. Now, this has to do with damages that Stone Creek is complaining of on its counterclaims. Now, obviously, if Stone Creek breaches the contract, it's probably not entitled to any damages. But if we get to the issue of whether Stone Creek proved its damages, that is a factual finding. Appellant is correct in that it's a question of law what the proper measure of damages is. But the proper measure of damages is this a breach of contract damage? Is it a breach of warranty damage? Is it a tort case? That type of issue is a question of law. Whether appellant proved its damages with reasonable certainty, that's a question of fact, and the Plywood Oshkosh case that was cited in the brief establishes that. So there are very few issues in this case that would not be subject to the clearly erroneous standard, and on the issues of credibility, that would not be due great deference from this court. In preparing for oral argument, I read that appellant or respondent's counsel should not presume to make an argument better than a well-drafted trial court opinion. Well, in this case, we have two well-drafted trial court opinions, Record 85 and Record 96. Record 85, the trial court lays out the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and it goes into great detail in doing that. Record 96, the trial court, this was on the motion for reconsideration, the trial court anticipated that this court would be facing this appeal and included in that decision a timeline showing what happened in this case and why the court reached the decisions that it did based on the total circumstances of the case. Based on those trial court findings, I would request that the Court of Appeals rule that the trial court's findings are not clearly erroneous, that the credibility determinations are entitled to due deference from this court, and I would request that this court affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Bradbury?
Obviously, I recognize the issues and the uphill battle we have on credibility, but in reviewing the record in this case, I would like to point out the extreme position that we think the district court took on the credibility issues. And in Exhibit 229 in the trial record is a letter that Stone Creek sends to Carnes. Carnes admits that they got a envelope certified mail receipt, admitting they got something. But they testified, we don't know what was in the envelope. All the undisputed evidence in the record showed there was a letter from Stone Creek in that envelope that objected to various things going on, including the conditions in Stone Creek's, in Carnes' acknowledgement. So in reviewing the record, I do ask that while the standard of review that appellee's counsel cited is correct, there is evidence in the record where the court went beyond what we think the court should have done in making those credibility determinations. A few other just quick issues on The issue of waiver, if the facts are not in dispute, it is a legal analysis. So while the court, you can't find the facts as the court, district court found, ultimately it's a legal analysis as to a legal conclusion as to whether a waiver exists. And as to the Chase breach of contract and what happened during the period from the initial contract to the modification, if you look at the record, it's not in dispute that we do have the summary judgment decision, which the court says they accepted the purchase order in full. And then Carnes was very careful after that point to issue change orders on that contract, and they issued two change orders. So for them to come back now and say the contract was modified in all these ways when they had a clear practice to issue these change orders does raise makes their position somewhat suspect. That's all I have. Thank you for your time today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.